Mark, I know we've been discussing the recent launch of the King Abdullah Center for Interreligious and Intercultural Dialogue. We both read at least one news post about that this week. One was an article from Rabbi David Rosen, and he says it's a really important step in the interfaith initiative. And wanted to see where you find yourself leaning as you hear about this next step in the interfaith movement. I know you and I've talked in the past about these key distinctions between interfaith and world spirituality, and I'd love to hear your take on these new developments.
Wow, no, that's great, Joe. Actually, I saw your post today. I think, where are we today? November 29th, 2012, and I really enjoyed it. Let me give just a couple of words of background. First up, David Rosen's a lovely man. I don't know him well. I haven't spoken to him in probably seven, eight years. I had one long talk with him. And then actually, here's just a funny piece of history. Many years ago, I shared an apartment with a kind of friend, older brother person named Mark Belford. Right, in an apartment building called the Century in Riverdale. And David, you know, when you're reading this, you're going to remember David lived for a while across the hall. Literally, we were apartment 617, and David was across the hall. He was then the chief rabbi of Ireland. And I remember a couple of lovely Sabbaths that we spent together at Mark Belford's table. And he was even then, you know, deeply interested in interfaith. And if I understand correctly, I haven't tracked that community carefully. David's really dedicated his life, you know, to very deep work in the interfaith community, and particularly with the Catholic Church. And now I see that he's expanding, you know, his work into the Islamic world, which is fantastic. So just a deep bow, you know, to David and to his work. So that's one. Two, in the article that you posted, Joe, there was this sense that this new interfaith center, you know, funded by these leading Muslim countries, including Saudi Arabia, would help reduce religious violence. And I believe that was the notion, which is...
That's right. That was one of the hopes.
Yeah, one of the hopes. And, I mean, all we can say, I mean, you and I have talked about this so many times, that's wildly important. And I think it's one of the primary purposes of interfaith. That, you know, interfaith dialogue, you know, its great contribution... Right, is that instead of, you know, faiths engaging in a aggressive, brutal contestation, you know, contestation is the formal technical word, right, you know, kind of argument between the faiths, in which one faith considers the other one to be infidel, right, in one way or the other, or, you know, makes a distinction between those who are chosen and those who aren't, but then even worse, says that those who aren't, right, let's, for example, Dar el-Harb and Dar el-Islam, the people of Islam, as opposed to the people of the sword, or the people who should be killed by the sword, or the infidel is to be killed, right? And that's one of the great tragedies of ethnocentric consciousness. And that interfaith movement, right, challenges that consciousness from within, meaning people who are completely committed to their faith, right, actually come and say, even though we're committed to our faith, and even though the great texts of our faith would seem to command an aggression and violence to each other, we actually don't accept those voices. We actually accept the deeper consciousness of other voices of peace and love, but in toleration in our faith. Right? And so we engage in interfaith, which says we each hold our own position. We think the other is completely wrong. Right? And yet, you know, we want to engage in, you know, a deep level of mutual respect. And that's fantastic. And that's fantastic. And in some sense, the early interfaith movement in the church in the mid-50s was a result of the church's complicity in the Holocaust. Right? The Catholic Church, you know, Pope Pius has a dismal record in relationship to the Holocaust. And Pope John, you know, in the mid-50s, you know, had a deep realization that the church had to do its own kind of atoning. Right, and particularly needed to change its doctrine, right, that the Jews were responsible for killing Christ. right? You know, deicide, right? The killing of God, for which the Jews had been held responsible. I mean, let's not talk about the absurdity of how can someone kill God? Because when you demonize someone, you know what I mean? Right? When you demonize someone, you never let things like that go get in the way. And of course, the structure of demonization is very powerful. The structure of demonization is you do something bad to someone because you're afraid or jealous of them. So the church attacks the Jews, right, because the Jews didn't accept Jesus. And that seems to invalidate, right, the basic claims of the Christian church. So the church attacks the Jews. Right? One, once you attack someone, you have to justify your attack. You create a negative downward cycle, so you have to demonize the person you've attacked. That's two. You know, three, you know, people in your, you know, friends of yours, associates of yours, right, or people in your hierarchy, right, are afraid or have vested interests which allow the supporting of the attacker, the demonization. You know, and finally, four, you know, good people stand by and do nothing. And that's how the process happens. And so that process, which happened with the Christian church vis-a-vis the Jews, right, was set in stone, you know, from at least the time of Constantine in 315, you know, until the early 60s. I mean, that's shocking. You know, and that created an enormous, right, amount of tragic murder and violence, and the early interfaith impetus of the Catholic Church and the Jews was to overcome that violence, right, through creating an actual interfaith bridge of mutual respect, tolerance, you know, for the basic human dignity of each other. And so, you know, David's work, you know, David Rosen's work seems to be in this interfaith gestalt, which is unbelievably important. So I think the first thing, you know, from the perspective of Center for World Spirituality, that I think we want to do is just really bow to that great work. You know, it's not the work that we're doing. Like, that's not where we're focused, right? David has, you know, Dr. Rosen has, obviously, and many other people that work with him have great skill and depth in this, and you know, more power to them and our full support and admiration. So that's, I'd say that's point one. Now we get to point two. And point two is important. Because as interfaith emerged, right, as interfaith emerged in the early and later 60s, you know, someone said something about it which really captured its weakness. You know, someone said that, you know, interfaith dialogue between Jews and Christians in the United States, which was, Joe, as you know, run essentially by very liberal Jews who were in some sense alienated from their own source and tradition and largely, you know, not deeply familiar with the integrity of their own sources. But, you know, and Christians who were, you know, kind of, so it was kind of liberal reformed Jews, very distant from their own sources, and, you know, liberal Protestants, very distant from the kind of mysteries of Christianity. So someone said that interfaith is when Jews who don't believe in Judaism get together with Christians who don't believe in Christianity and discover they have a lot in common, right?
Now, right.
You know, that's the shadow of interfaith, right? That's the weakness. The strength is everything we've talked about until now. The weakness is that interfaith often didn't come from the leaders of interfaith, you know, very, very different than Dr. Rosen, who's not of this ilk. But often the impetus in leaders of interfaith came from the idea that, well, you know, really, our traditions are important. Really, you know, they're all saying basically the same thing, and you know, why should there be any distinction at all? And let's just all agree that we're all wonderful people and we should respect each other, which is in part wonderful and in part very difficult because you actually lose the great unique self-contribution of every tradition. And every tradition has a unique self and a unique set of gifts, right? And interfaith was often driven by people that didn't recognize the unique lineage gifts and obligations, right, and mystery that were held by each great tradition. And it was actually a reduction of the mystery, right, a defacing of the mystery that became the ground of a kind of, you know, civil intercourse which lost the great depth, revelation, and realization of the traditions. And so that's the place that we really need to kind of take issue with interfaith. So that's one. That's interfaith both in its positive, right, and its shadow. Now, if you have a few minutes, I would love to go a third step with you and maybe just kind of chart, because you mentioned this in your blog, and I thought your points were all completely correct, and I love them. You know, what's the relationship between kind of world spirituality and interfaith and other expressions of these kind of movements? So do we have a few minutes to talk about that?
Yeah, we sure do. Go ahead and give me a brief overview.
Okay, brief overview coming at you, JP. Right, this is my name is Mordechai, so I'm Mo, and you're Joe Perez, you're Joe. So as we said before we got on the call, together we have Mojo. So here
yeah,
we
yeah.
go. So here we go, and thank you for taking the time to spend on this. So here we go. Let's just do it very, very briefly. You know, the kind of world spirituality expressions today, you know, I would say that there are kind of, five, six, or seven major expressions, right? You know, they're all different versions, right, of this kind of universal impetus. And world spirituality both transcends and includes the best of all of them. So one is interfaith that we've described, which is, you know, let's have good relations. Let's respect each other as human beings, you know, and let's leave the doctrinal differences aside and certainly not allow them, right, to justify violence and murder. That's wonderful. That's interfaith, right? A second version, right, of interfaith is called interreligious diplomacy. And our colleague, you know, Charles Randall Paul, heads up the Center for Interreligious Diplomacy, and we actually recently did a dialogue with him. And, you know, Charles is really about, you know, contestation, that there should be religious argument, right, which is different than interfaith. But he's saying, actually, no, let's take each other seriously, right? And let's actually have real religious argumentation. Let's try and persuade each other. And let's do the ancient version, the medieval version of contestation, but out of a mutual sense of dialogue and respect. Because that's the second version. And that's saying not just let's respect each other, but let's engage in genuine dialogue to actually show where we differ, show where we think the other is wrong, right? Have a genuine pluralistic dialogue in which we're not effacing differences. We're not engaging in the classical shadow of liberalism, which is the leveling of all differences, right? And all, we're actually highlighting distinction and difference and living with the creative tension and paradoxical tension that creates in our relationship, holding the depth of love that emerges from the fraternity that happens when we come and see each other face to face. We actually see each other face to face. But in the face of the other, right, the doctrinal differences are themselves effaced. Right, and the deep shared humanity between us, right, emerges, right, even as we engage in fierce contestation. So that's interreligious diplomacy. And it seems to me that Charles Randall Paul is a major expression, right, of that that idea. You know, three, you know, there are people like the Dalai Lama, right, who's talking about, you know, being beyond religion. The major Dalai Lama theme. Right now, of course, the Dalai Lama is a little bit disingenuous here because he's not actually moving beyond Buddhism. Right? But what he's saying is that the religions no longer speak, right, to many, many groups of people, and that we need to look for, right, you know, a language which is beyond religion, right? And that's already a new move, right? And that's closer to world spirituality, to a dimension of it, right, which is this notion that we're looking for an actual shared language which doesn't violate the integrity of the traditions but emerges from the depth structures of every tradition. And that's beautiful, right? That idea, right, finds deep expression in what our colleague, may his memory be blessed, Wayne Teasdale, called interspirituality. Right? And Wayne Teasdale actually was the person who invited me to meet the Dalai Lama and to participate in the synthesis dialogues. And Wayne's interspirituality basically says at the mystical core of every great tradition, there's a shared conversation. Right? The deeper you go into the mystical core, and that was an idea that I'd worked with for a long time, so when I met Wayne, I was just really resonant with it. Right? And Wayne really championed that. And that, you know, that gave birth in many ways. It didn't give birth to, but it helped the development of the Parliament of World Religions. That there's a mystical core where we meet, which is of course true and deep and profound and real. There is a mystical core that we meet, which is shared, and mysticism becomes a matrix for this great shared conversation. And that's fantastic. That's beautiful. Then that's four. Then five. There's the perennial philosophy. The perennial philosophy that was championed by people like Fritz F. Schuon and René Girard, and, you know, Fritz F. Schuon, one of his key kind of intellectual disciples, was, of course, Easton Smith, and you know, Shuan and Houston Smith had enormous influence on our colleague and integral mentor, Ken Wilber. You know, Ken really, as he said to me in many private conversations, kind of cut his teeth, you know, on the perennial philosophy, which was really kind of really held and developed at the LA Vedanta Society, right, in a very, very strong measure in the early 60s with Gerard Hurd and escapes me right now, right, but a number of key figures, right, and this notion of the perennial philosophy was related to inner spirituality, gave birth to actually Wayne Thiesfeld's inner spirituality, it influenced Wayne enormously, but the basic idea is that there are depth structures in all the great traditions, right, that are shared by all the great traditions. Some of them are mystical, others are not mystical, but there's these core depth structures, and this is what gave birth, again, to Wayne's inner spirituality, that are shared in all the great, you know, pre-modern traditions. And those should be what guide us and what move us in the world. And so perennial philosophy, as I said again, probably the third time, gives birth to inner spirituality. It's about these shared depth structures, which are the perennial philosophy. Right? And Aldous Huxley, in his famous book, The Perennial Philosophy, right, is a student of Fritz Schuhan. Right, in this school, but also Aldous Huxley is very involved in the LA Vedanta Society in this conversation. That's the perennial philosophy, you know, conversation. Right? World spirituality takes a perspective on all of these and deeply bows to the truth in each one of them, and at the same time says that each one of them is true but partial. That interface, right, makes its very special contribution. Right, perennial inner spirituality, its contribution, right? The notion of, you know, moving beyond religion, the Dalai Lama's notion, right? You know, its contribution. Right, but basically what world spirituality says is that if we just respect each other, we lose the great lineages and their great contribution. If we just look for the shared mystical or the general shared proposition of all the great traditions, right, that's a beautiful thing to do. But what that would mean is that we're actually being guided by pre-modernity. And because all of the great traditions were really formed in pre-modernity. And so world spirituality says, yes, right, we accept that we receive reverentially, right, the great contributions of the great traditions in pre-modernity. And we also recognize this distinction between surface structures and depth structures, which is a core distinction of Fritz Schuhan, and that religions have surface structures, rituals, right, beliefs, dogmas that are different, but share depth structures that you can actually identify. And when we do cross-cultural research in the last 120 years, we're able to, for the first time, identify, right, the shared features of all the great traditions. As we gathered all the texts and there were meetings between all the living teachers, and we realized, wow, there's a deep shared experience here. As Thomas Merton, who was good friends with Suzuki Roshi, right, they realized, wow, there's a deep shared experience here. And so that was influenced by perennial philosophy and helped give birth to inner spirituality. And that's fantastic. And we're with that. We completely receive that. And we also say that there's key knowing that comes from modernity. The modernity's demand for evidence. That modernity, which begins somewhere around the Western Enlightenment to identify developmental sequences, right, structures of consciousness, right, that emerge across culturally, across the planet, right? So we begin to identify science, psychological structures, developmental structures, and we believe that these have an enormous amount to teach us. And we take these seriously. And so we want to actually receive, right, the great depth of modernity, right, as an actual source of wisdom, right? And we also want to receive, right, the great depth, right, in postmodernity, right, the truths of postmodernism, which includes constructivism, which is that the world's not just a perception, but the world's an interpretation, that we're always interpreting. Contextualism is that all truths are context-dependent and contexts are endless, right? Integral aperspectivism, which is that no context is finally privileged. Therefore, you know, a fully world spirituality integral view has to include multiple perspectives, right? Pluralism, multiculturalism. So all of these, you know, really, really important insights and truths, right, you know, are part of postmodernity. So we want to receive the great truths of premodernity, which is basically inside of perennial philosophy. We want to have deep mutual respect and honor for our shared humanness, which is interfaith, right? The shared mystical truths, right, which come from inner spirituality, right, right. We want to also debate. We want to have fierce debate between religions when each, right, upholds the integrity of its own lineage, which is interreligious diplomacy. And we want to also receive the best truths of spirit and action as they reveal themselves in modernity and postmodernity. So world spirituality is the evolutionary emergent that takes into account and honors the contributions of all these expressions and then says, let's integrate them, you know, into, right, a higher vision, right, in which a person can either be a dual citizen, meaning practice in a great tradition, while at the same time be a participant in a world spirituality which has its framework and its set of, you know, its bucket list of practices, right, which are critical, and we can unpack those in a different conversation, right, and, you know, at the same time, right, take into account the best of pre-modern, modern, and post-modern. Right, so world spirituality, because otherwise, if we make the perennial philosophy move, right, we're making a regressive move. We're saying that pre-modernity guides us. And we don't want to make that move because pre-modernity was ethnocentric, homophobic, right, you know, anti-body, anti-feminine, anti-sexuality, right, it was about, right, in other words, it was an ascendant move in spirituality and not an eminent move, and we want to merge the two. And so it wasn't an integrated Shiva and Shakti, it wasn't an integrated masculine and feminine, and so we don't want to actually be guided by pre-modernity. We want to actually accept the best insight of modernity and post-modernity, integrate these three great traditions, the traditional, the modern, and the post-modern, and get to this post-postmodern place, this new place, where we can, again, be dual citizens, live in a tradition, and live in a world spirituality, right? Or, right, we can be that part of that huge group of people that no longer live in a tradition, but we actually begin to develop a genuine lineage, right, of committed obligation and sacrifice and practice, which is a world spirituality practice by whatever name you call it. And so I hope that gives us just a little context for the conversation, both for our deep admiration for interfaith and for kind of the larger context in which it operates.
Perfect, Mark. This is just what I was looking for. Appreciate your taking the time to add that depth of insight to this very timely topic.
Well, I totally appreciate you hosting me in this context, and have a gorgeous day, sir, and blessings to Mojo.
Okay, Mojo, Mojo.
Okay, amen. Over and out.
All right.